Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Black holes are having a moment in popular culture, thanks in part to last year's award-winning film Interstellar, in which brave space travelers played by Anne Hathaway and Matthew McConaughey experienced the dramatic effects of time slowed down by its proximity to a fictional black hole called Gargantua. In science, the moment of black holes has been stretched to centuries of speculation, then doubt, and finally acceptance of their existence throughout the universe. As my guest will explain, black holes are actually a fascinating lens through which to chart the forward progress and sometimes the missteps and diversions of scientific understanding of the universe. Marcia Bartuszak is professor of the practice in the graduate program in science writing at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. Her new book is called Black Hole: How an Idea Abandoned by Newtonians, Hated by Einstein, and Gambled on by Hawking Became Loved. Marcia, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
I have to tell you, when we received this book for review, we were almost taken in before we had opened it just based on the title. Can you talk about what you've learned about what makes black holes so fascinating to non-scientists in a way that other astronomical phenomena are not? Goodness.
I like to think of them as the ultimate horror show. They're the astronomical equivalent of dinosaurs. Everyone loves dinosaurs because there's that thought that, oh, I could possibly be eaten by a dinosaur, but you know you're safe because they're far in the distance in time. And black holes are similar. There's this sense that you could get swallowed up and never return if you got caught by a black hole. But we're safe because they're far off in the distance. There are hundreds, thousands, even millions of light years away.
And it does seem that every time we learn something new about their nature, their properties, it's more fascinating. The idea that something caught on the event horizon of a black hole from a distance appears to be there forever.
Yes, that's because time slows down in a gravitational field. In fact, this happens to us here on Earth. The satellites that surround the Earth and keep track of our motions for GPS actually have to take general relativity into account because the clocks up on the satellites run faster than the clocks down here on Earth, just by very, very tiny amounts, but enough that it would get the GPS coordinates all mixed up, and they have to make those corrections. The black hole takes this to the ultimate limit. The black hole is such a gravitational a stronghold that time slows down and literally stops at the event horizon.
Well, let's talk about the first father of gravity, Isaac Newton. What made his work so revolutionary, and what was left incomplete by Newtonian physics?
What Newton did was develop the equations that enabled anyone with the proper training to make predictions about the behavior of gravity. He discovered the inverse square law. He could then plot the trajectory of a cannonball being fired out of the cannon. He could plot the motion of the planets around the sun. This was an amazing accomplishment that he could actually come up with a mathematical law that predicted physical behavior. What he couldn't do, though, was describe the mechanism. Back in the 17th century, you know, physical laws were described as mechanisms. His competitors always wanted something to be working for gravity. Descartes had these vortices of ether that move things around. Johannes Kepler thought that magnetism was the operating principle behind gravity, causing things to move. Newton had a set of equations, but he couldn't tell anyone why they worked. There were just these, to him, invisible tendrils of force that he found the laws for. And that, for a while, was a real problem for him. In fact, his laws of gravity weren't readily accepted right away until Edmund Halley predicted, based on Newton's laws of gravity, that there would be a comet that returned at a certain time. Now, Halley predicted this. He didn't live long enough to see it come back, but indeed the comet returned, and of course it was called Halley's Comet because of that prediction. And once people saw that Newton's laws of gravity could predict a comet coming back, well, then everyone said, okay, these laws work. I don't care about the mechanism. And that worked for a long time, but it had to await Einstein to actually show how gravity worked.
I have to tell you, I loved learning why. I mean, we know Halley's Comet is special, but I didn't understand why it has been considered so special over time. It proved Newtonian physics were correct.
That is true. Put it this way, while the scientists knew that Newton's laws were quite momentous, for the general layman, that was quite a feat to predict something decades ahead of time that was going to come back.
Okay, I'm going to skip around here a little bit, and we'll get back to Einstein in a minute and what was left for him to solve by Newtonian physics. But can you go back through for us and explain what a black hole is exactly? It's like one of those things we think we know but may not fully understand.
It is. I'll talk about stellar black holes, and it's really the ultimate death of a star. Stars die in different ways. Our sun, for instance, will not die as a black hole. It's simply not massive enough. It doesn't have enough mass to collapse down to a point. Our sun when it runs out of fuel, the outer atmosphere eventually will evaporate off, and what will remain behind is the core of the star, about the size of the Earth, and that's called a white dwarf star. And that's what's going to happen with our sun. But, you know, if our sun were just a bit more massive, if the core of our sun were more than 1.4 solar masses, it would have a different fate. It would ultimately collapse to a neutron star where all of the matter collapses and forms one big atomic nucleus just about 10 miles wide. In a sense, it's one big ball of neutron particles. And that happens for stars that are more massive than our sun. But then for the stars that are the most massive of all, there is a limit for the neutron star. If you put just a little bit more matter onto a neutron star, if it's more than two or three solar masses, then it's going to continue to collapse. No longer will the nuclear forces hold the star up. Gravity takes over. In fact, so much so that the star collapses, collapses, collapses to a point. And around that point is the boundary line. That's called the event horizon. And that's the point at which if you pass, there's nothing there at the event horizon. It's like the boundary of a nation. It's once you cross it, you can't get back out. And you yourself would plummet down to the singularity, the point of matter at the center.
So is a black hole cone-shaped, for lack of a better term?
No, actually, it's three-dimensional. That event horizon is literally a spherical object in space-time. But it's kind of hard for us to envision because at the same time, it is warping space and time. So it's twisting space to the point that when you go in, it is like a pit of space-time that has been dug in and has no bottom.
So we now know that there are black holes at the center of every galaxy. What is their function within galaxies?
That is what astronomers are trying to figure out. It looks as if these supermassive black holes, they have the mass of millions, even billions of solar masses, and astronomers just now are looking back further and further and seeing that these holes are being formed very quickly. They may be part and parcel of the galaxy formation process. In fact, they're even thinking maybe our very existence here in a galaxy depends on that supermassive black hole forming in the center. But this is very new information that astronomers are getting, and they're not quite sure. But it looks from the statistics they've been carrying out that every major galaxy has a supermassive black hole in its center.
So you can't really see a black hole. Talk about how scientists identify them in the center of galaxies.
I know we think because a black hole sucks in everything and gives nothing back that you'd wonder, well, how would we ever see them? In fact, early on, when physicists were struggling with this idea, they thought at first that, well, why bother thinking about these theoretical objects that we'd never see? But as they have learned, starting in the 1960s and into the 70s, that new arenas of astronomy enabled them to see, quote, with quote marks around that, black holes. And that's because black holes, because they have such strong gravitational fields, will draw in matter that is close by. But it doesn't, like, instantly go into the hole. Matter, well, it's like someone said, all these cars trying to crowd into the parking lot of a football stadium. It takes time for that matter. As it's approaching, it starts swirling around the hole on the outside, and there's a big traffic jam. And while it's getting sucked up by the black hole, it's giving off, as it's falling into the hole, it's giving off a lot of energy. X-rays, radio rays, visible rays, gamma rays. And that is what astronomers see, and how they are able to detect these black holes is from all of this matter giving off energy before it actually gets swallowed up by the hole.
Okay, back to history. I have to tell you, I was stunned to learn how early speculation began about something at least akin to what we now call a black hole.
Yeah, I like to think of it as the Model T version of the black hole. It happened in 1784. This wonderfully brilliant scientist that no one really has heard of today, his name was John Mitchell. And he was a polymath. He was a geologist. He was a mathematician. And he was also an astronomer. Today, if anyone knows of him, it's as the father of seismology, because he was the first one in the 1700s to suggest that earthquakes were really elastic waves moving through the earth. He was quite clever. And he hung out with all of the greats of the Royal Society of London, like Priestley and Cavendish, and even Ben Franklin when he was visiting London. And in 1784, John Mitchell started thinking about, what if I had a star so massive that it had such a great gravitational field that light couldn't get off its surface? And he actually calculated what this would look like, and he said it would be 500 times the mass of our sun, and it would stretch out, if we did that, filling the orbit of Mars. That was his version of the black hole.
We're speaking this hour with Marcia Bartuszak. She is professor of the practice in the graduate program in science writing at MIT. Her new book is called Black Hole: How an Idea Abandoned by Newtonians, Hated by Einstein, and Gambled on by Hawking Became Loved. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Marcia Bartuszak. Goodness, I'm so sorry, Marcia. Marcia Bartuszak, she is professor of the practice in the graduate program in science writing at MIT. Her new book is called Black Hole: How an Idea Abandoned by Newtonians, Hated by Einstein, and Gambled on by Hawking Became Loved. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Okay, you were telling us about John Mitchell and his ideas in 1784. It's remarkable to think that he was conceiving of this in an era where no one really understood space-time. How did astronomy and its underlying assumptions change when Einstein, almost exactly a century ago, articulated general relativity?
Well, what John Mitchell did was think of one big lump of matter that was out there preventing light from getting off of the surface. He had the wrong theory of light. He had the wrong theory of matter. He had the wrong theory of gravity for explaining this. No such possible object could exist. And the idea did go nowhere. And it didn't revive until Einstein's theory of general relativity. And what Einstein did with relativity, general relativity, was actually inform us of the origin of gravity. It wasn't these invisible tendrils of force, as Newton had us think, but it's actual curvatures in space-time. Matter actually indents space-time, and gravity is that effect of, well, to put it simply, going down the slopes. We are in a well, so to speak, with the Earth sitting in space-time, and we have been sliding down towards the surface. That's what keeps our feet on the ground. And that's what Einstein did. He, through his general theory, was able to provide a mechanism. But it also changed the outlook of the black hole. It was no longer a big lump of matter. It was something else.
Was Einstein the first one to imagine that space might be curved?
There were people earlier. The mathematician Riemann, actually, and Gauss had thought about space being curved. It was an idea they had in the 19th century. In fact, Einstein used Riemann's mathematics of non-Euclidean space, curved space, to formulate his theory of general relativity. But they didn't fully develop it because the missing piece is it's both space and time connected that form this fabric that is bent, not just space itself, but space-time.
For the general public, Robert Oppenheimer's name is synonymous with nuclear weapons. What did he contribute to our understanding of black holes?
He actually developed the first modern description of black holes. Einstein did not come up with the idea of black holes, but his general theory of relativity was used to come to the description. There was an earlier form. It was actually a man named Karl Schwarzschild, a German astronomer, who first put out the hint that something odd can happen if all of the mass of a star were collapsed to a point. And J. Robert Oppenheimer, in 1939, this was before he became the father of the atomic bomb, he and his graduate students started looking at this idea in more detail. And in doing so, he came up with his graduate student, Hartland Snyder, with the first modern description of a black hole, not of as a big lump of matter, as John Mitchell had thought about it, but literally as the collapse of all matter to a point and space-time getting so twisted that it cut off from the rest of the universe.
Of course, 1939 was not an ideal time to publish a revolutionary scientific paper.
Exactly. No one, absolutely no one paid attention to this. First of all, general relativity, this is not, you know, we always think of Einstein as having this wonderful reputation as, you know, general relativity was discovered. It was proven in 1919 with this famous solar eclipse experiment, and that, you know, celebrations went on from that time on. But actually, it went into the shadows because there wasn't much that physicists and astronomers could do with general relativity. And it wasn't until 1939 that Oppenheimer and his graduate student actually showed, general relativity is showing us that there may be these weird objects in the universe. But it was 1939. In fact, the very journal that he published in also had another paper on nuclear fission, far more important at the time and attracting far more attention. It also came out on September 1st, 1939. And if anyone knows their history, that was the very day that Hitler marched into Poland and started World War II. Physicists had far more on their minds than these obscure entities, which he called gravitationally collapsed objects. It didn't have the fancy name black hole yet. It went nowhere.
And Einstein himself published a paper rejecting the notion that black holes would form out of massive collapsing stars.
He did not like the idea at all. We have to understand that Einstein was really, I like to say, the last of the classical physicists. He grew up and learned his physics in the 19th century. And even though he did all of these wonderful things, his Nobel Prize was based on quantum mechanics, and yet he then later walked away from it. He didn't quite like all of those probabilities he wanted cause and effect. And general relativity itself is a very classical mathematical theory. And the fact that all of a stellar mass could collapse to a point, he just couldn't imagine that that happened in the universe. He was sure that other forces would come into play. He tried to prove it in a paper just a few weeks after Oppenheimer came out with his paper, and it was pretty bad. In fact, historians now think of that paper as his worst scientific paper.
What did Einstein miss when he made the calculations that led him to dismiss black holes?
He rigged the game. He set up some centrifugal forces to keep the matter from falling into the center. It was completely wrong physically. He rigged the game. It was not his best day at doing some physics calculations.
Marcia Bartuszak is my guest. We're talking about her book, Black Hole. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here from John in Plano who says, I've always thought gravity was an attractive force. However, even Newton didn't believe in any such thing as a force that is attractive. Force acts as pushing. In a program about Einstein's theory of general relativity, it described Einstein showing that gravity is an object falling because of space-time. I cannot wrap my head around this. Can you clarify what gravity is?
Oh, it is an attractive force. Two objects are attracted to one another. It just is that the attraction is caused by geometry, the geometry of space-time. At least that's one framework. It turns out you can still rewrite the equations of Einstein into the familiar forces at work that we think of, electromagnetism and the nuclear forces. But it is one way to picture it, that mass in dense space-time, and we are following the geometry. That is why we are attracted to the center of the Earth. The thing is, it's very hard to imagine this with our three-dimensional minds, because what's really happening is the curvatures are in four dimensions, space and time together. So all the pictures you usually see in the textbooks are two-dimensional versions, like a black hole looking like you're going down into a space-time pit. But it's really four dimensions. The curvatures are in space plus time.
And gravity is a weak force. It does so much in the universe that it doesn't seem quite right to say this, but gravity is ultimately a weak force. Is that correct?
It's very weak. I mean, think of it. A magnet, a tiny little toy magnet, can pick up a paper clip against the entire Earth, pulling down on it, a little toy magnet. Where gravity gets really strong is in when we're talking about very large scales, the scale of the universe. Then gravity is the strongest force. But on little local levels, it's very, very weak. You have to go to the universe at large. And also, when mass is compressed to great extremes, like a neutron star being only 10 miles wide, or where matter collapses to a point, then gravitational fields become very, very strong. And that's why general relativity at first was kind of ignored. In fact, his critics said, well, I don't see what the use of general relativity is, because in our everyday life, you don't need general relativity. Newton's laws work just fine. We went to the moon and back based on Newton's laws, not Einstein. And it was only when we started discovering these unusual, very active, weird, bizarre objects in the universe, like neutron stars and black holes, did general relativity come back to the forefront and become one of the leading areas of astrophysics.
Are neutron stars the same as quasars?
No. Quasars, neutron stars are stellar. Quasars are the very active centers of galaxies. They are the supermassive black holes taking in all of the matter around them. And as they spin and as they gather the matter in there in the center part of the galaxy, they emit tremendous amounts of energies. Supermassive black holes act as these huge electro dynamos, and they're spinning, and they send jets of matter out of their poles. And that creates the tremendous energies that you can get in no other way. Gravitational energies, that is actually the way that the most efficient energy generator in the universe is a gravitational engine like a spinning supermassive black hole. It puts out the energy of billions and even trillions of suns.
And that energy doesn't come from having been inside the black hole. It comes from being right there on the edge and not quite getting sucked in?
It's the energy released right before the matter goes in, mm-hmm. and also the spinning. When a black hole spins, it becomes like an electric dynamo that fuels our electricity. And the electromagnetic fields get wrapped around the black hole and form these channels so that matter can go in and sort of swiftly go out the poles right before it gets to the event horizon. So some of the matter is accelerated outward using the spinning of the hole as its energy generator.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Stephen writes to Twitter, can a black hole become so massive that it might eject mass or matter from our universe into a possible neighboring universe?
There are theorists who have and are considering that possibility. One theorist, Lee Smolin, thinks that there's a sort of cosmological evolution going on, that there are other universes, and that each universe formed in another space, another time, is formed every time a black hole in our universe forms, so that there's these multiverse of many universes, each one created when a black hole forms, and all of that compressed energy then goes into forming the Big Bang of another universe. Right now, sheer speculation. None of this will be fully known until they get a well-defined theory of quantum gravity, mixing quantum mechanics with gravity. It is the holy grail for theoretical physicists, and they haven't done it as yet. But it is being speculated on.
How did scientists come to understand the phenomenon called redshift, and why was that important to research and science of black holes?
There is a phenomenon known as gravitational redshift. Redshift, there's also blue shifts. What we're talking about is the actual light waves being either compressed, made smaller and hence bluer, or stretched out and made longer, hence redder, either because an object is moving away from us or because it is coming out of a huge gravitational well and the light waves getting stretched. In terms of Einstein, the gravitational redshift, as I said before, matter causes space-time to indent, and this creates a space-time well, so to speak. And light, picture the Earth sitting in that space-time well. Light coming off of the Earth, all the lights that are on the Earth as that light exits from the surface of the Earth, it is literally climbing out of that space-time well. And as it is, it's like a spring stretching, and it gets longer and longer. And so the light coming off of the Earth gets stretched a bit and made redder. And therefore, that is the gravitational redshift.
We're speaking this hour with Marcia Bartuszak. She is professor in the graduate program in science writing at MIT. Her book is called Black Hole: How an Idea Abandoned by Newtonians, Hated by Einstein, and Gambled on by Hawking Became Loved. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with MIT's Marcia Bartuszak, whose new book is called Black Hole: How an Idea Abandoned by Newtonians, Hated by Einstein, and Gambled on by Hawking Became Loved. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Marcia, can you talk about the role, albeit small, that the city of Dallas played in the black hole's journey to respectability?
It wasn't a small role. It was a turning point. As I mentioned earlier, general relativity for a while through the 30s and into the 40s had gone into the background. No physics department was teaching general relativity. Not many physicists were specializing in it. It was going away. And then the astronomers started discovering these odd objects. And in 1963, they discovered the quasar, these very active galaxies at a far, far distance. They found out that they could see these objects from billions of light years away. What possible source of energy was creating this? So there was a small relativity group there in Dallas, at what is now the University of Texas at Dallas, and they decided to put on a conference and specifically invite general relativists and astronomers to discuss what is creating the quasar phenomenon. This was just 3 weeks after the Kennedy assassination. In fact, they thought maybe we should cancel the conference, but they held it anyway. And they had 300 people, including J. Robert Oppenheimer, all gather to try to figure out what is the energy source of these quasars. And they were thinking maybe it was Oppenheimer's gravitationally collapsed objects. But at the same time, they had in the workup, in the outline, how can we avoid this possibility? They were trying to still get rid of the idea of the black hole. And so these 300 people gathered in Dallas for the first Texas Symposium on Relativistic Astrophysics. It was a turning point because it was the first time that a large group of people were starting to see that there might be a purpose to general relativity to explain these new odd phenomena. And it was a momentous occasion. These symposiums are still held every few years around the world, but still known as the Texas Symposium in honor of the first one held in Dallas.
What other names were bandied about before we settled on black hole?
Oh, yes. They were known as dark stars, black stars, collapsers, gravitationally collapsed objects. Try to put that on the cover of the book. I think I'd have about two people buying it. It took a while to settle in on the term black hole, and it didn't really happen until 1967 when it was finally accepted into the scientific literature. But it actually came out a little earlier than that, in the early 1960s. This was an interesting little point I discovered as I was researching this book. It's long been thought that the dean of general relativity in the United States, the late John Archibald Wheeler, had come up with the term black hole. It turns out that the actual person was a Princeton theorist named Robert Dickey. He used to give lectures in the early 1960s about the possibility of these gravitationally collapsed objects, and he would tell his audience, it's like the black hole of Calcutta. Something goes in and it never comes out. And he just sort of did this jokingly in his lectures. And some other people picked it up. The term was used in 1963 at the Texas Symposium, and also a little later, American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting a few weeks later. So the term was out there, and Wheeler adopted it officially, and he really gets credit because he had such a reputation in general relativity that once he adopted the term, everyone, all the other scientists, astronomers, physicists, felt they finally had permission to use it. It wasn't just a joking term, that they could actually use it in the scientific literature as the official description. So Wheeler made it official.
How did Stephen Hawking become such a champion of black holes?
Well, he has actually was the originator of the looking at the black hole from the perspective of an atom, opening up a whole new investigation into black holes. In fact, this is what I consider Hawking's most important work, was in the mid-1970s, his looking at the black hole from the atomic perspective. And when he did this, he found out something very surprising. He saw that at the event horizon, it's like a turmoil. Atoms and particles, elementary particles popping in and out of existence. And what happens is sometimes the energy right there at the event horizon creating these particles, one of the particles will go into the hole, but the other will come flying out. And over time, Hawking saw that a black hole actually is evaporating, that it's not the total black hole that we think of that swallows everything and gives nothing back. On an atomic level, it actually does give away matter very, very sparingly. It would take 10 to the 67 years, that's a one with 67 zeros, for a black hole to totally evaporate in our universe. That's beyond the age that we will likely exist. But still, he was seeing that when you look at the black hole from the perspective of quantum mechanics on the level of an atom, a black hole looks very different. And that has been Hawking's legacy, is he opened up a whole new way to look at the black hole. And it's changing. It's changing our perspective on black holes.
What are gravity waves?
Oh, yes, gravity waves. Gravity waves are the gravitational equivalent to electromagnetic waves. Just as electromagnetic waves, like the very radio waves that are allowing this program to go out to your audience, there are electrons moving up and down an antenna, putting out the waves that are being modulated and allowing your audience to hear, both you and me. But the equivalent in gravity is if two masses start moving towards or away from one another or circling around one another, they are creating waves in the very fabric of space-time. And these gravity waves emanate from that event, just the way electromagnetic waves emanate from the sun. But they are not going through space the way radio waves or light waves are. They're actually vibrations in space-time. In fact, if a gravity wave, say, the sun suddenly turned into a black hole. And
which you already promised is not possible.
Is not possible. But what if? What if it collapsed and sent out a huge from the collapse, then there might have been a bounce, and it would have vibrated space-time and sent out a gravity wave right nearby us. As it went through the Earth, it would literally compress and squeeze, compress like an accordion, space-time. A 6-foot man would be stretched to 12 feet and then squeezed down to 3 in a matter of a millisecond. So you'd be vibrating up and down and torn to pieces. But fortunately, that's only if you're right nearby an event like a supernova or two black holes colliding. Most of those events are very, very far away. And by the time they reach Earth, then they're only moving space-time by the width of an atomic particle. And they actually have working instruments that are looking for such events right now. They haven't found them yet, but they're on the air, and they are looking. Several gravity wave observatories are now placed around the world looking for such events.
Marcia, you have such a gift for explaining extremely heady science in ways that regular people like me can at least get a grasp on what you're talking about. Are you at the point now where nothing blows your mind?
Oh, that's a good question. Sometimes I do, you know, I've been covering astronomy and astrophysics now for more than 30 years. And I think I have gotten a little more conservative. Sometimes an idea comes out and I cock my little eyebrow up like Mr. Spock and say, I wonder if this is true or not. Right now, they're talking about when you enter a black hole, you wouldn't plummet to the singularity at the center, but you might, from a quantum mechanical outlook, just bump into this huge firewall of particles going in and out of existence. No one knows as yet. So there's a part of me that holds back until they get the proper theory to describe this. So I'm a little wary of speculation right now, perhaps a little more conservative than I was 30 years ago, because I have seen so many ideas come in and out and change over the years. I remember in 1967, there was the thought that there might be white holes along with black holes, where there were these objects that would constantly spew matter and energy out like a fountain. In fact, it was thought maybe quasars were that. And it turns out, no, quasars are actually black holes spewing out matter before it enters in. So, you know, there are some wild ideas out there, and they come and go. So I think the more I see that, the more conservative I get.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, on the one hand, you really need to look at these things with some skepticism. On the other hand, sometimes it's the ideas that strike the entire establishment as insane that prove to have an element of truth or to be entirely true.
What is needed is a marriage of theory and observational evidence. And that's why black holes had such a struggle for 50 years. We look back and we think, oh, why didn't they embrace this right from the start? But for 50 years, starting in 1915 with general relativity and the first idea from Karl Schwarzschild, until the observational evidence in the 60s and into the 70s, all it was theory. And yes, you could embrace it, but without that observational evidence, it was that. It was only a theory. And physicists had every right to be cautious until the observational evidence was so overwhelming they had to cry uncle and say, yes, you're right. These things do exist in the universe.
For lay people who don't have a strong science background but really want to stay informed, are there particular like publications that you would trust and send people to sort of keep up with what's happening?
Well, on the web, NASA has wonderful sites giving information about all these various objects, and they keep up to date. And through those various NASA sites, especially the space telescopes like the Chandra X-ray Space Telescope that specializes in looking at these energetic objects like neutron stars and black holes and the supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies, they have a wonderful selection of material to give background information on. And then, of course, there are the wonderful general reader magazines like Scientific American and Discover and New Scientist, all of these, and Science News, all of these are very good sources to go to, both as a hard copy publication, and they also have presence on the web.
Marcia Bartuszak is professor of the practice in the graduate program in science writing at MIT. Her new book is called Black Hole: How an Idea Abandoned by Newtonians, Hated by Einstein, and Gambled on by Hawking Became Loved. Marcia, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
You are welcome. It was a delight.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker, produced today by Lindsay Connect, and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones from Celine Alba. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter over at Chris Boyd Think. If you'd like to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.